This is Wyman and Bob
on Seattle Sports, powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Some really good stuff today. If you guys are just tuning in, we had a conversation with Paul Moyer earlier. Then we spoke with Scott Servais. And then we just spoke with John Schneider of your Seattle Seahawks. So all of that has happened while you were gone. Where were you? What were you doing? If you missed any of it, you'll find it on the podcast page at seattlesports.com. Just click the podcast tab, scroll down to our picture, click on that, and it's right there waiting for you. Click subscribe. That's what you need to do. That's the key to all of it. Then you never have to worry about it again. Brady, you and I were talking during the break about the A's situation.
Yeah.
And now they're going to be playing in West Sacramento for the next 3 years after this season. And Carter from Tacoma texted in the very obvious part that I hadn't even really thought of. He said, that means we have to play there too. That's right.
Oh, I didn't even,
consider the Mariners, every team going through there playing in West Sacramento. So, yeah, those will be fun trips for the Mariners for at least three seasons, it sounds like.
So is that its own city? Is there Sacramento and then there's West – it's like West Hollywood?
I don't really know. I don't know who goes to Sacramento, much less West Sacramento.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting. But, hey, at least the A's owner is super excited about being there. Really, really quaint ballpark. He's really happy and excited.
Yeah, we were talking about this, too, in the break. Like, is there another city? I mean, you imagine they would – if they're going to relocate somewhere and as like a temporary home, there would be some other city on the West Coast.
Well, they were looking at, as far as temporary spots, this was one they were talking about. Salt Lake City was one they were looking at as well, a minor league ballpark, I assume, out there. But in terms of a permanent move from Oakland, we were talking about, well, maybe they could move to Portland if they want to stay on the West Coast. I don't know. You know, they'd have to build a stadium, but – Yeah,
as you said, you know, typically when a team is you know, looking at moving into another city that doesn't have that, you know, franchise, that other city is welcoming them with open arms. And as you said, they're rolling out the red carpet, and that's not what is happening in Vegas. And so that made me wonder what other city, like, is there not a better option out there than Vegas? I mean, even if you're just limiting it to the West Coast, you would have to think that there's another city out there that would be more welcoming to them.
Yeah, and is Lefko back there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm here.
When we were talking about this before, the plans for the stadium in Vegas were on a very small footprint to where they weren't able to have a retractable roof. Wasn't that right?
Yeah, the Tropicana Hotel site. So it's jammed in among a bunch of other things. I haven't been to Vegas in a while, so I don't remember where it is. But yeah, there's not a lot of room to build around there.
So they're talking
is there, though? I mean, I go to Vegas every now and again, and you go a block off the strip, there's just empty lots upon empty lots. Like, it seems like, and granted, you probably don't want to go too far off the strip because you want to be centrally located, but is there really not enough space out there to do it anywhere other than the old Tropicana site?
I think that's where they want it. The A's, if they want to be there, they bought that land and they want to be there.
And so they're going to have no roof or a permanent roof?
No, it's that like half awning overhang. They have renderings up now, so I don't know how it's gonna actually work.
You can't have a day game there in the
probably
summer.
Not.
So I would imagine early, like April, beginning of the season, you'd have your day games. But once you start getting into June, July, August, you can't have day games
too
in
hot.
Vegas.
No,
people will die.
Yeah, I mean, I've golfed in some pretty warm weather, and it reaches a certain point where it does not become enjoyable when you're in the desert in the middle of the day.
It's perfect that it's an absolute cluster and it involves this dimwit.
Well, you want to hear the best part before we move back to, you know, football things. So that stadium obviously hosts a Triple A team, and
right,
that team's still going to play there.
So
they're going to have to work
around
that.
Around the Triple A.
So the A's aren't even technically the main tenant in a minor league stadium.
Oh, in West Sacramento.
Think about the poor grounds crew. They're working every day nonstop.
Hey, but John Fisher's super excited to be there. Super excited. What a disaster. Goodness. All right. Well, we'll see what happens with the A's. But Carter sent that in. I hadn't even thought of it. Like, ugh, now they have to go there too. The Mariners will have to play there and every other team that plays the A's in what will be home games for them in West Sacramento. So that should be fun. All right. Well, we had John Schneider in earlier. Again, that conversation will be on the podcast page after the show. But we asked him about, you know, Stephon Diggs was the big trade that just happened. And now you look at a Bills team going, well, Gabe Davis is out. Stephon Diggs is out. They're going to be looking at receivers, you would assume, in the draft. They're currently at number 28, I believe. So the idea of them moving up becomes very realistic. And we talked to John about how something like that can affect the first round with, as far as their perspective goes.
You know, we've talked about it in the past. So the pro guys, you know, are in charge. They're basically the pro scouts or the experts with their specific teams. So, you know, DJ, Armani, Willie, those guys, like, okay, so what is, you know, Buffalo's world look like now? You know, what kind of ammunition do they have? Would they want to be getting up into the area we are if we want to be moving back? Yeah, absolutely. It's a constant conversation.
Would you love to be a part of, like, just be a fly on the wall in those rooms as they have these conversations and building towards the draft? I think it'd be interesting just to hear how they're evaluating what other teams are doing. Like, if they're going, oh, did you see what Buffalo did? All right, here are the receivers that should be around us. They're going to want one of these guys. I don't know, just kind of based on every other team's needs and moves, how it impacts you.
Well, to answer your question, yes, I would. It would make my job a whole lot easier. Yeah, if I could be in on those conversations, sure. It was a good question about, you know, about Buffalo specifically, because they badly need wide receiver help now, and they are at 28. So going from 28 to 16, if we're just throwing out, you know, if we're going to help them with this hypothetical trade, mm-hmm. we'll do the legwork on it right here. So if you just look at the trade value chart, this is the old Jimmy Johnson chart, which basically assigns like a point value to every single draft
pick. Is that still considered the chart? Like, do people still follow that, or has there been a new way to calculate value, or is that?
Yeah, I think there's different variations of it that are more of an updated look at, hey, what is this pick really worth based on, you know, what this pick has generated in recent years. I think teams have their own variations of it that they work off of, but, you know, just as a general rule, like the Jimmy Johnson one, he developed it, and so this is kind of the original one. If you just look at that, so basically what it does it assigns a point value to every pick. And the idea is there to then make it easier to make equitable trades. So if that Seahawks pick at 16 is worth 1,000, I think according to the chart it's worth 1,000, then Buffalo's pick at 28 I think is like 660 or something like that. So in order to make up the difference, you know, Buffalo would have to give the Seahawks, in addition to 28,
something that's worth 340.
Right, which if you look at the chart, that ends up being like a kind of mid-late second-round pick. So that would be an interesting trade, given that the Seahawks don't have a second-round pick. But again, the question is, would they want to move all the way back to 28? You know, if they have a certain number of guys that they really like and really want, would they feel like they can still get that guy at 28?
Yeah. The reason I ask about is everybody using that, because you look at moves that have been made, like the 49ers, Trey Lance. They give 3 ones in a third?
Something. I believe it involved 3 ones. I don't know
three
what
ones
the rest of it was,
there
was but
one
it was
more
a ton.
To move up to that spot, which doesn't sound like it's following that point value.
Well, it's the closer you are to number one,
the points go up.
Yeah. So that's why you see a lot of teams trade from, like, you know, somewhere in the 30s. Into the late 20s, you see a lot of teams do that, and a lot of times it's for a quarterback. And the idea there is, they, you know, it's even if you felt like you could get that guy at in the mid 30s, you give yourself a better chance of landing that guy, the quarterback, but you also get that fifth year option that comes with a first round pick, and you know that's can be very valuable for quarterbacks. But I think generally, it's even if you're moving up the same amount of spots, like say going from 35 to 25, I believe, I'd have to look at the chart, but I believe it's costlier to go from, you know, from 25 to 15 as opposed to 35 to 25.
Gotcha. Yeah. And that makes sense. That makes sense. He wasn't going to tell us if they're going to move up or down at 16. We tried, but I don't know, I guess predicting, do you still believe in the tendencies of the past? Because John was a part of it.
Yeah.
John's been here the whole time. Pete's gone. That's a big element. And it's funny him telling the stories about, hey, Johnny, you see this guy? I love this guy. You see the way this guy, you know, like he's like a cheerleader and super hyper. I don't know. Does the absence of that alter their approach, or are we going to see something that resembles what they've done in the past?
Well, yeah, he was describing, you know, what Carroll was like in the pre-draft process, as they're evaluating these guys like around this time of the year. I think he also said something interesting there, which was that Pete pretty much let him do his thing. And he said rarely, I don't want to quote him because I don't remember exactly what he said, but he said that, you know, Pete almost never, you know, put his fist down and said, you got to take this guy, which he could have done because he didn't have a final say.
Yeah, so he would get a sense he wasn't comfortable with a particular move that they were talking about.
Yeah, and certainly they didn't see eye to eye on every move they made over the last 14 years. But I think his point was that Pete, especially in the draft, pretty much deferred to John and let John run the show. And so in that sense, I don't think it's going to be all that different. I still think you're going to see them really look for value. It's a team that's always been very intent on finding value. And you know, if you can, again, it goes back to the idea of when you're picking late in the 20s and you feel like you can get the same caliber guy at 36 as opposed to 26, then, you know, there's incentive there to move back 10 spots and get the same caliber guy, but still pick up an extra pick. And I think that, I still think that's going to be the MO, but on the flip side of that, it's a little different when you're picking at 16, because, you know, you're more likely to get a true first round talent that falls to you at that spot than you would be in the mid 20s.
One of the other things we talked to him about was just in, you know, they're planning their cap space. It's very valuable. They've got very little to work with, but they have to set aside a certain amount for their draft picks, which, you know, talking to him about altering that, currently they have 7 picks. That can change. If they trade back from 16, they're going to accumulate more picks, in which case they would need more money. Granted, the first pick would be cheaper than it would be at 16, but the budget would then change a little bit. Here he is talking about that.
When you go up, you're adding cash, right? So, you know, we are at 16. The signing bonus slated there is like 8.5 compared to the big one last year at 5, right? The difference is huge. So, yeah, you have to be careful, you know, make sure you're budgeted appropriately so that, you know, if we do move up, it looks a certain way, or you're moving back and acquiring more, you know, more players. But then that signing bonus number is a little bit slotted lower. You know, but you're still adding another whole signing bonus. So yeah, you have to be flexible and pliable and just be, you know, strict with you know, what that's going to look like.
Yeah, and the key word there that he used is cash. And I think there's a tendency among observers to only think about this in terms of cap space, and everybody thinks that, you know, NFL teams print money and they just have endless reserves of cash. I mean, it obviously is a multi-billion dollar industry, but, you know, these teams are also businesses that are trying to turn a profit and they operate under cash budgets. So, you know, the teams like Dallas, which you just see constantly them, you know, they do have a lot of cash on hand, and you see them kind of structure their contracts and operate accordingly. But most teams aren't like that, and they operate under, you know, somewhat strict cash budgets. And so the point John was making there was, you know, when you're picking at 5, you know, Devin Witherspoon was the 5th overall pick last year. I think he got a $20 something million
right,
signing bonus. That's an upfront cash payment that you have to make. Now, a lot of times they defer chunks of the signing bonus into later years, but even then, that's still a big chunk of, even if you defer half that, that's still a big chunk of cash that you've got to pay up front. And so there's a key distinction there between, it's not just cap space. You know, you can usually create cap space, but a lot of times to do that, you need cash to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes you appreciate what guys like Matt Thomas and people he brought up, you know, from the past, in terms of the capologists, if you will, whatever their official title is. And some teams I know employ 2 of them.
Yeah.
You know, so it is the NFL salary cap to me is one of the more confusing things in all of sports, because it feels like it's, I'm not going to say easily manipulated, but it is manipulated in ways you're just like, wait, this says they've got X amount of dollars, but somehow they just signed this guy who's making $20 million a year, and they move this guy, they put this now becomes a signing bonus as opposed to a roster bonus. I mean, just all the different variations in it, and these little holes they find in order to do what they need to do with personnel is really confusing.
Yeah, it's very arcane stuff, and it you know, it's all because these contracts aren't guaranteed. I mean, if you look at a baseball contract, it's very straightforward.
Yeah, NBA, and same thing.
Yeah, it's
you sign for $100 million, you're getting $100 million.
Right. Yeah. If you you're getting a certain amount of money every year, and it's not really going to change. It's a lot different in the NFL because the contracts aren't guaranteed, and so there's a lot of different, you know, mechanisms in there. to try to put money in certain spots, and they can, it can be maneuvered and changed and everything. And so, yeah, it's just way, way more esoteric than any other pro sports contracts.
Yeah. John talked about that he's very aware that they need help on the O-line. As he said, message received.
Yeah.
Even though he's not on social media, he's hearing it from somebody. But he talked about that they've had guards in the building, which you talked about as well, and plan to sign a veteran, and they're going to keep looking throughout the offseason.
We've had some guys in. We'll continue to do that. We've had some veteran guys, that, you know, guys that have started games, and put another veteran in that group, and then, you know, hope to address draft as much as we possibly can. But, you know, and then all, you know, it's, again, we're not playing games tomorrow, so we'll continue to, you know, work our way through post-draft, trades, summer, all that kind of stuff. So it's not an area that's being ignored.
Yeah, he did not name names, but I will name the names for you. It's Greg Van Roten was the guy that they had in yesterday, 34 years old. And if that name sounds familiar, he actually had an off-season cup of coffee with the Seahawks 10 years ago, then went on to the CFL. He started games for a number of teams since then. Last season was with Vegas, and he's a solid starter. They previously met with Lake and Tomlinson, and then Cody Whitehair is another guy who's very much on their radar. I know they've been trying to bring him in for a visit. I don't know if that's happened yet or if it's planned to happen sometime soon, but I have gotten the sense that the top two options are Tomlinson and Whitehair, and then Van Roten is also there as maybe a fallback option, but I do think that you're going to see them sign one of those three guys here sometime in the near future.
Is there one of those three you think is head and shoulders above the other two, or do you feel like, they're all kind of similar to each other?
Yeah, I kind of think that Whitehair and Tomlinson are similar caliber players. Now, Tomlinson is, I think he's 32 years old. He was a first-round pick in 2015, I think 28 overall by Detroit, and he is remarkably durable. So he's missed one game in nine seasons. That's incredible at any position, let alone offensive line where, right, you're, you know, banging into each other all game long. He's missed a total of nine snaps combined over the past five seasons. So just a Iron Man. Yeah. And now he would be a left guard specifically. He's pretty much only played, I think 99% of his career snaps have been at left guard. Whereas Whitehair, he's been more of a versatile interior guy. He actually made the Pro Bowl, I think in 2018 as a center. And since then he's predominantly played guard. And so he would offer more position versatility. I think he was like sixth last season in pass block win rate. So he is still a pretty good pass protector. So yeah, both of those guys would bring something to the table. And the one thing they would both bring to the table is a veteran presence, you know, on an offensive line that is still pretty young, even though they signed George Fant, who's another veteran guy, you know, on the interior specifically, there's not a whole lot of veteran presence there. And either one of those guys or Van Roten for that matter, would add some of that.
Was Paul the one suggesting that they talk about Abe Lucas as a guard?
Yeah.
I don't love that. I think he's a really good right tackle. His biggest problem is just availability.
Yeah.
He's got what sounds like it's a chronic thing, not just a, oh, this is torn, we're going to fix it, or this is broken, it needs to heal. It sounds like it's more of a condition that they're going to need. I know he had a surgery, but is that supposed to cure it, or is this something that's going to have to be, there's going to be maintenance at all times with this?
Yeah, I think that remains to be seen. Now, the one word that gives me pause, and granted, Pete Carroll is not a doctor, but he did use the word chronic at one point last season, which, you know, that would seem to imply the type of injury that may not necessarily be cured with surgery. So Abe Lucas did have surgery on his right knee sometime after the season. So obviously the hope is that that's going to fix it, but hearing the word chronic, that does make me wonder if, you know, that was part of the reason why they signed George Fant. And they gave him, you know, a decent amount of money, I think $4 million and change per year, to be that swing tackle, a guy who's obviously played right tackle and left tackle. He did both with the Seahawks. And so, you know, they needed to have a better insurance policy at right tackle than they had last year. And George Fant very much gives them that. He's making a little bit of money, but as
a
guy,
1 year deal, right?
Yeah, but as a guy who started a ton of games and who had a pretty good year last year with Houston, very reasonable deal, and I think a smart deal considering the unknown with Abe Lucas's knee.
Yeah, it's I love what Abe Lucas looks like when he's out there, but when you hear that word chronic, you're like, oh boy, this is the idea of him just being a steady force out there, a presence out there. 17 games doesn't – that feels like that's nonsense.
He might have been their best offensive lineman. I think he was in 2022. And even when he came back last year, I know he missed, you know, a good chunk, I think 10 games in the middle of the season. And when he came back, I thought he played well. Again, it's just a matter of, you know, what that's going to look like. I don't think they've had any serious thought about moving him to guard, but it was interesting what Paul said about, you know, he sort of looks like the body type of where who could, you know, he's a big, powerful guy. Just, he wouldn't seem out of place there just physically. But I haven't gotten the sense that that's something they've strongly considered.
Yeah. I wonder if that would be more beneficial to him physically. Would the demands be less on that knee as a guard as opposed to a tackle? I don't really know, but yeah, it's an interesting thought. All right, coming up, we got some more insight on Laviska Shenault, what he'll bring to the Seahawks team. We'll get into all of that. Coming up with Wyman and Bob, Brady Henderson in for Wyman, live from the Virginia Mason Athletic Center. This is Seattle Sports on 710.
Wyman and Bob,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio
on Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app.
So a couple of things we talked to John Schneider about, and again, in case you're just tuning in, we had our conversation with John Schneider that we have every week. The John Schneider Show took place earlier. That conversation will be on the podcast page at seattlesports.com after the show. We were talking about some of the new rules that will be in place, and one being the kickoff rule, which I guess unless you watched the XFL, you don't really know what it looks like. So that would be me. I didn't watch the XFL. Wasn't that interested. What happened to your headset? All of a sudden, is not working.
How about that?
No.
Oh, it's because I got the wrong headset.
Brady put on the wrong headset. Hold, please. There we go. I can hear that one.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, oh, that's much better.
Right. You got multiple headsets here. Bound to happen.
Across the room. So I didn't watch the XFL. I don't know. I've been reading what it looks like. We've talked to John about what it looks like. I got to be honest, it sounds a little hokey. You're going to have two returners back there. Nobody can move until the ball is they field the ball or it lands or whatever, which is weird because the receiving team, as he said, will be looking back at the returner. And then once contact is made, then they're going to turn around. And it looks like you're potentially going to get plowed by the guy. Like he's going to have at least a step on you at that point.
Yeah. So I think the two ideas behind this rule change, one was to, what was to increase the number of actual kickoffs. So, and to still keep the injury rate down. So I think the NFL, their data showed that as a whole, there were fewer injuries on kickoffs with the previous rule changes that they made, but the fewer kicks were being returned. And so the rate of injuries per actual kickoff return was not really down. There were just fewer injuries because there were fewer kickoffs. And so they were trying to kind of have it both ways where they keep the injuries down, but they actually promote kickoffs to actually be returned. And so the idea here is they're moving the, you know, all but the kicker, everybody from the kicking team, they're moving them closer to where the ball is going to land. And so basically you're,
yeah, everybody's across midfield except right. for the kicker, right?
Right. So you're reducing the speed at which the kicking team and the kick return team, where the majority of those players are colliding, right? So the kicking team has, you know, a lot less of a head start. So there's less space between them. So there's not going to be as much force behind the collision. But they're trying to actually promote kickoffs to actually be returned. It's hard to explain how it actually works, but the upshot of the new rule is that you're going to see two returners back there as opposed to one. And as John Schneider told us, that was a big reason why they signed Laviska Shenault, just because he has some kickoff return experience the last couple seasons. Of course, they lost DJ Dallas in free agency. And with the new rules, you know, yeah, maybe D. Eskridge slides into one of those spots, but it's not just as simple as saying, okay, it's a one-for-one replacement. You really need more than one guy back there.
It's interesting. D. Eskridge is – we'd asked John about that before because initially, I was fascinated by D. Eskridge, and then I was frustrated by D. Eskridge. I was fascinated because he was sort of propped up as being a version of Tyreek Hill, a guy who can, you know, he's got this explosive speed, and he can be this multidimensional weapon, a receiver, a guy you're going to use on these jet sweeps and returns, and he's been anything but. He hasn't been on the field.
Mm-hmm.
He's had issues off the field, at which point I'm thinking, all right, is he worth the roster spot that he's occupying? And when we asked John about him, he said, you know, maybe if Pete were still here, they probably would have felt like it were better for him to give it a shot elsewhere. So I took that as Coach McDonald looking at him going, I can do something with this guy potentially, or I'm trying to justify his spot on this roster.
Well, yeah, at this point of the offseason, you got 90 roster spots, so it's not like he's taking one of 53. He's taking one of 90.
But he did get a guarantee. I know not a big.
I don't think. Yeah, so I think he took a.
Was it a million something?
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I'd have to pull up the contract, but I believe, and maybe some people on the textoy can help me recall this because I can't recall it off the top of my head.
You,
but
you
I think that he. I think it's still non-guaranteed.
Okay.
And I think he may have taken a little bit of a pay cut from what he was scheduled to make. So you actually are getting him on a pretty inexpensive contract that's still only for one season. And again, he's only taking one of 90 spots, and he's not guaranteed a spot on the 53, it doesn't sound like. And so, yeah, I don't see any real harm in him, you know, and then continuing to take a look at what he's got, especially, again, with the new kickoff rule. You lost DJ Dallas. You need a couple guys back there. I still think certainly it's been a disappointing run for him in Seattle, but I don't really see any issue with him, at least with them at least giving him a shot to see if he can make something happen this year.
Yeah.
But it definitely is now or never for him.
Yeah, I mean, he was their first pick in the year they only had three picks. And it was a second rounder, but still, you've got nothing, no return on investment there. You know, it wasn't ultimately an awesome draft. It was him, it was Trey Brown, who showed some promise initially and has been hurt, and I don't really know what his role is going to be. And then Stone Forsythe was the third one that year. Was kind of a project and
right.
depth guy. So I don't know. I'm just sort of his presence is unique to me.
Yeah. So $1.055 million base salary. Looks like none of that is guaranteed. This is according to Over the Cap. I don't know what the contract looked like before that, but I believe that they actually brought the number down and there's still no guaranteed money there. So it's really a flyer. It's kind of like LaVisca Chenault, who's on a 1 year minimum salary deal that actually counts a little bit less against the salary cap than the total dollar amount of the deal, because there's what's called a veteran salary benefit. So, you know, only $167,000 signing bonus for him, which is not a whole lot in terms of NFL dollars. So, you know, a 1 year flyer on a, like D. Eskridge, Chenault was a former second round pick who is actually, you know, compared to Eskridge, he had a nice start to his career. I think he had over 600 yards his first couple seasons in Jacksonville, and then, you know, really hasn't produced a whole lot since he got traded to Carolina, but a big body, a guy who has some history of production. And as it relates to the kickoff return, he's got some experience doing that as well.
As far as the receiver role, you think he's going to be somebody that they, I'm not going to say they're going to feature him prominently, but if they go to a four wide receiver set, is he that guy? Is he a better, ultimately going to be a better option than Bobo, or how does he fit in the depth?
Yeah, I would imagine that he's probably competing with Derek Young for snaps as like the big bodied receiver to kind of back up DK Metcalf at that spot. And then Bobo is obviously in that mix as well. So, but you know, when you're talking about, you know, guys like this, I back into the receiver depth chart type of guys, I think he's probably going to factor more on special teams. That would be my guess than he would in the receiver core. When you consider, you know, you've already got your top three guys set and you know, you're going to get some good production out of those guys. So there's typically not that many balls to go around for the fourth and fifth guys. So I would imagine that, you know, he's probably going to factor more on special teams than on offense.
Hey, just back to the kickoff. For a moment, all of this is done to try to mitigate injury, try to lessen injury wherever they can, which I can appreciate. But I you know, Dave and I talk about this all the time. I'm not saying injuries don't happen on kickoffs. I just don't. The way it's portrayed is like every time there's a kickoff, there's somebody who's being helped off the field, and I just don't remember it that way. I don't recall seeing, but I'm sure you've seen the numbers to sort of back up the motivation for making these changes. Are they pretty substantial? Because I just don't recall seeing guys constantly every kickoff somebody's being helped off the field or carted off the field. It doesn't feel that way in watching.
But yeah.
What are the numbers?
No, I agree with you. It doesn't seem like that anecdotally, but I think the NFL statistically would tell you that is, you know, the most dangerous play on a per play injury rate basis, that you just get more injuries on kickoffs than you do on any other play. And so and you know, it makes sense just because of the mechanics of, at least under the old rule, where you've got 250 pound guys that run 4.4 and they got a 40 yard running head of steam, right, and they crash into these guys. And so even with eliminating the wedge, which they did a decade ago, and trying to make that play safer, I think they would tell you that their data shows that it still has been the most dangerous play in football. And that's the idea behind moving the majority of the kickoff team on the other side of the field, so there's just less speed, less of a running start by the time the two teams collide.
Yeah. All right, coming up, we don't understand it, but people keep trying to compare Stephon Diggs' situation to DK Metcalf. We'll get into some of that coming up next. We got Brady Henderson in for Dave Wyman today. This is Seattle Sports on 710.
Wyman and Bob,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio
on Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app.
Something we got into to open the show, Brady, and again, if you're just tuning in, Brady Henderson in for Dave Wyman today, Seattle Sports on 710. It's Wyman and Bob. We were talking about the big news in the NFL was Stephon Diggs being traded to the Texans, and then it sort of led to DK Metcalf, because even yesterday, Dave and I were talking about it, this perception of him as being the stereotypical diva wide receiver. You know, give me the ball. I need the ball. I need, you know. And Stephon Diggs has made that very clear when he's unhappy about how he's being used. DK Metcalf, to my knowledge, from people I've talked to on, off the record, talked to you who are as embedded as anybody, nobody's ever heard him utter a word about not enough targets. Never, never once that I'm aware of. Yet, even on the heels of us saying that, somebody texts in and going, oh, that's bull. He's a whiner and he's happy if he gets the ball, but if he doesn't get it, he's unhappy. I'm thinking, where does this come from? Just because you think it in your head doesn't make it so. I think they see him animated on the sideline and go, ah, wide receiver, typical diva.
Right.
Where he's mad at the opposition. He's yelling at the player or the ref or whoever he's getting animated with. But I've never seen that directed at Geno, get me the ball, or Russ, get me the ball, or Pete when he was here, get me, I need more touches. That's just never been yet to a group of Seahawks fans, it's just true.
Yeah, and I think that's just a case of making assumptions about a guy where you kind of project a certain behavior that you see with other receivers and you think that it's all the same, where every high-profile receiver is obsessed about targets and they get upset when they don't get them. But yeah, to your point, we have not ever seen anything like that. Certainly we've seen him lose his cool,
yeah,
on the field, and to a point where at times it's actually hurt the Seahawks. But that's always, as you said, that's always about the opponents getting under his skin, mm-hmm, and whatnot. And we haven't seen, now granted, we're not at, we only see what we see. We see the games, reporters like me can watch the team during training camp. So we don't see what happens at practice during the season because that's closed off to us. So we don't know if there's certain things that happen then, we don't see them. So, but based on what we know and what we've seen, yeah, we have not seen him get upset the way it looks like Stephon Diggs has gotten upset. And again, as I said earlier, I think DK deserves credit for being as available to the media as he has been. And not every guy wants to talk after a loss, certainly not after, you get one of those penalties and the questions are going to be about, a play where you hurt the team. And so to his credit, he's always been available. I think for the last couple of years, he's done a weekly thing at the podium. And then, he's always available post game whenever we want to talk to him. And so, yeah, I think it's you can certainly say that there is the volatility there, but it's not fair to say that he is like every other diva receiver who, is upset about targets, because we just haven't seen that.
Yeah, and in the case of Diggs and other, Keyshawn wrote a book. Get me the damn ball. Other guys are just very obvious. They'll tell you, I need to be a bigger part of what's going on out there. I can't score if I don't have the ball. And it's just been a long history, and it does often attach itself to that position above others. So I get the stereotype, and it does come from somewhere. It doesn't apply to everybody. As animated as he is, I've just never heard it. And the idea that should be the impetus to trade him in the minds of some, I'm looking at it going, why would you want to trade him? I could see if your logic is, no, it's not about him being a problem. It's about he's the most appealing piece of the team to another team out there in terms of return. I'm going to get the most for him, and then you brought up Witherspoon. Those are probably the two most valuable players on this entire team in terms of what you could get in exchange for them. So on that level, I understand the logic. I wouldn't do it unless somebody's going to unload their entire draft for it, something crazy that you'd be foolish to say no to. But, we played that clip earlier of the Kansas City guy going, hey, would the Chiefs give up number 32 for DK? I'm not sure, but if they did, I'm like...
Something tells me that they would.
Yeah. That better be the beginning of the package that you're talking about there. That first round, and then what, next year, or a second and a third? I mean, I don't know. I just, the conversation about trading him is confusing to me because he represents something this organization has never had at that spot.
Yeah, no, go back to how hard they looked and how long they looked to try to find that guy. I mean, remember all the big bodied receivers that they brought in here under Carroll, the original Mike Williams who Carroll had at USC, who had
too big of a body.
It got bigger. Ended up being pretty big. they tried to sign Vincent Jackson. They brought in Brandon Marshall for a visit, I think as a restricted free agent 1 year. That was the whole deal where they flew him in on the seaplane.
Yeah.
And then they ended up signing him towards the end of his career, I think in 2018. Braylon Edwards.
Brought up Terrell Owens.
Terrell Owens even had an offseason stint here in 2012. So
TJ Houshmandzadeh.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just throughout the years they've tried.
Yeah, spent Sidney Rice, spent a fourth-round pick on Chris Durham. So the list goes on.
Kevin Norwood.
Kevin Norwood. There's a blast from the past.
They had a couple of fourth round receivers that just didn't happen.
Chris Harper was another guy.
Harper, yeah. Went to the 49ers after he left here, right?
Yeah.
Durham went to the Lions, I think.
Yep, and he may have played in Canada. I'm not sure, but the point is they spent a long time trying to find that type of receiver, and that goes back to the other point of, okay, let's say you trade DK Metcalf. Let's say you get a first-round pick for him. Okay, maybe you hit on that pick. Maybe that guy ends up giving you somewhat similar production. But with DK, it's not just about the production. It's about all the attention that 6'4", 225 with 4.3 speed commands. That's the type of stuff that doesn't – I mean, the production is great, but there's attention that he commands beyond that. It's hard to replace because you just can't find a guy who's that big and that fast at the same time.
And that physical. He's a very willing blocker as a receiver, and he's a very effective blocker as a receiver. And the guy's missed one game in five seasons. One.
Yeah. Yep. And after coming into the NFL with questions about the durability, he had the neck injury that ended his career at Ole Miss. God, I had a great point, and I just totally lost. I swear it was a great point, but I just lost my train.
You were ready to dazzle with this
point. Oh, it was so good. You wouldn't believe it.
Well, in regards to DK, something about his
His
production, his blocking, his durability.
It's about I was just going to make the point that don't get me wrong. Like, they're not they weren't thrilled about some of the stuff, last year with the penalties, and then there was a little bit of defiance in one of the press conferences.
Right.
There was a time where Pete Carroll said that he showed like the league leaders in penalties at receiver, and DK Metcalf was up there. And Carroll was making the point of, he's trying to hold DK accountable in front of the rest of the team. And then DK, we asked him about it, I think later that day, and he sounded a little bit dismissive about it. I don't think that they were thrilled about that. So don't get me wrong about that. But again, when a star wide receiver is producing and playing as hard as he does and bringing to the team what he has brought to the team, you're going to be able to live with stuff like that, and when the production wanes and the off the field kind of difficulties are, at a certain point, then you're no longer willing to live with it. But I mean, the production is there, and I think the stuff that you have to deal with is stuff that you can easily live with considering all the pluses there. So
yeah.
I just don't – I mean, big-time players get traded for a number of reasons, and nothing that I think is happening with DK Metcalf would fit any of that. He's still producing. He's still young. He's still on a reasonable contract.
Yeah, just turned – what did we say? Just turned 26 in December?
Yeah.
So he's a young dude, and and financially – in terms of what star receivers are making these days, he's at a pretty reasonable cost. I mean, he's making a good chunk of money, but comparatively speaking, with some of the higher end receivers, I feel like he's kind of a bargain.
Yeah, it's a 3-year, $72 million deal he signed, I think, a couple years ago. So $24 million average, which it's a lot of money. But when you look at the receiver market, I mean, it's not out of place considering, you know, what he's giving you. And so the other side of this, which we haven't even talked about, is, you know, when you trade a guy with 2 years left in his contract on a big contract, you're taking on a ton of dead money. I mean, I think the number right now would be like $36 million. And I mean, that alone would make this a non-starter.
Yeah, which they're already taking on with Diggs and Jamal and everybody, all these other moves they've made.
Yeah, I think $20 million with Adams, another $10 million with Diggs. So between those two guys, you know, $30 million in dead money. But I mean, just in a vacuum, taking on $36 million a year to trade a still young, highly productive player, again, I think that alone just makes it a non-starter.
Yeah.
All right, that does it for us. I appreciate everybody tuning in. If you missed anything from today's show or any day, all you need to do is head to seattlesports.com, click the podcast tab, scroll down to our picture and click on that, and it'll be right there waiting for you. And as Dave and Lefko tell you every time, click subscribe. That way it's downloaded automatically for you. You never have to go through that process again. Either way, we appreciate you tuning in. We're back tomorrow right here with Wyman and Bob, Seattle Sports Station on 710.